Jerry has been the bulldog after NIST pulling on their pants, and the pants have come down. NIST has released the drawings now to us, the structural drawings, which we've been after for years and years.
Hello, everybody. Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you, as usual, from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, a very different kind of program, or programs, if in fact this has to be split up into more than one podcast, we shall see. We're going to be talking with Jerry, who is part of an independent research group of engineers that has for some time now, some years indeed, been researching technical questions about the collapses of World Trade Center buildings 1, 2 and 7 on 9/11, obtaining crucial data on those buildings via FOIA requests and sort of poring over those data with painstaking attention to detail. And some of you will actually remember that I actually had a podcast all ready to go back in 2018, a long discussion with Jerry, but at the very last moment that had to be shelved because the group decided, quite understandably, they decided that the conversation might just have got in the way, might have interfered with their chances of getting the last bits of data under FOIA request out of NIST, the US National Institute of Standards and Technology. And that, of course, would have been a great tragedy if the interview had caused that to happen. So I agreed to shelve that program. But, as I say, Jerry is back today. They now have the full set of data that they were seeking. And actually, it's better now because things have moved along, of course, since then, and better because it's not just going to be an interview today, it's going to be a sort of unusual round table with two other members of that group as well, David Cole in the US, and another researcher who goes by the handle Hitstirrer here in England, and of course Jerry in Scotland. And it's going to be unusual because only Jerry is going to speak. Not everybody wishes to speak on air for one reason or another, which is absolutely fine by me, but all three will be present in the discussion, communicating at very least by text message in the background as we speak. So a strange sort of setup, but an interesting setup. At some point also in the proceedings, we should be joined by none other than Richard Gage, who we've spoken to before, who heads up, as many of you, probably most of you will know, who heads up Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And hopefully we'll be getting his angle on how 9/11 activism is progressing these days. So as I say, quite an unusual programme. Let's start then with Jerry, David and Hitstirrer. Thank you ever so much, all three of you, for joining us on the programme.
Thanks for having us, Julian. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And am I waiting here for a text to come through to say happy to be here? No? Oh, well, I hope you're still there, chaps, in the background. Okay, we're going to be talking then about... Yes, thank you. You're very welcome to be on. We're going to be talking about your ongoing research, particularly into the Twin Towers, based upon this data that you've at long last obtained from NIST under these FOIA requests. Remarkable thing, really, to have achieved. Remarkable they've actually given you this data. But first, let's get an idea about the group itself. Jerry, could you tell us more basically about who you are? That is in as much detail as you're happy to share on air. And how you basically got into doing what you're doing with this 9/11 research.
I personally had an interest in 9/11 from the day that it happened, from a technical perspective. Just to learn, the opportunity to learn from whatever went wrong, what happened to these buildings. There is always an opportunity when the disaster structurally in a building happens. There is always that opportunity to learn. And I wanted to do that. And at some point, I had a lot of time on my hands because of an operation that had immobilized me for quite a period of time. And I bumped into these guys in a chat room on the internet, and they were these were the guys out of the whole group of people who were there who were technically very knowledgeable and capable of this kind of research. So the opportunity more or less unfolded and presented itself to us as a smaller group that evolved from a larger group of people who were discussing 9/11 generally on the internet.
Mm. And when you started looking into this, were you concerned in the sense that the official story wasn't You weren't buying it in some way, or were you looking at it just as a sheer academic kind of curiosity, and then you became suspicious of it? How did that work with you?
It certainly didn't make sense to me on the day when it happened to see these buildings having been hit relatively high up. My initial thoughts were that the people above those impact points were in a very, very bad situation, and perhaps the people below the impact points were in a slightly less serious situation. You know, I didn't imagine that the buildings would collapse like anybody else, and I therefore looked forward to the technical explanation that was going to come out to say, you know, what did happen.
Right.
And I did seek to arm myself with what information I could about the structures and to contact other people and to see if any of the doubts that I had about that day were being expressed by other people at a technical level. And they indeed were.
Okay, well, it's interesting that you come at it from that angle rather than immediately seeking to, as it were, poke holes in an official narrative, but rather trying to understand how it happened, why it happened, and then finding yourself in this sort of critical tension with the official position. That's very interesting.
Yes.
You are an engineer of by training, I understand. Is that true of everybody in the group?
Well, I mean, I have some qualifications on paper on engineering, quite a lot, but to be honest, not many of them came into use in the research that we did, with the exception of being able to read structural drawings and being up to speed with the kind of language. But everybody in the group had a technical inclination of some sort. Everybody was capable of looking at structural drawings and saying, that's what that means. That's this connection from this angle. That's the elements that are there. There's a bill of materials. And you need to have people who have that attention to detail. But I wouldn't say that qualifications were crucial to the kind of research that we carried out.
Right.
When that research moved forward, which I'm sure we'll discuss, then we're dealing with people who have lots of letters after their name.
I see, okay.
We were dealing at a kind of lower level than that. We were bounding problems less precisely than other people could once the research moved on.
Okay, and it's obviously very clear from talking to you before that your understanding of this is far, far greater than mine. So you obviously, all of you obviously have a great sense of what you're looking at here. And even though when you've expressed your concerns, you pass it on to others, as you say, who perhaps have more experience or qualification. Nevertheless, what you're doing is very valuable in throwing up those things for other people. Now, you said that your group does have a name, but you only recently found out the name of it.
Yes.
The 9/11 Accountability Team. Is that right? Is that what you're called?
Yeah. Yes, apparently so. David forwarded an email last night on behalf of us, and this is the first, I didn't even realise we've got a Facebook page. I didn't actually realise that, which is terrible, but there you go. We are the 9/11 Accountability Team. We learn something new every day.
Okay, well, what's in a name? Now, the really interesting thing for me is that you have a kind of informal connection to architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, hence, of course, Richard Gage hopefully is going to be joining us later. And there's some sense in which your work is then passed on to them. So, I mean, could you describe what that relationship is like between you and AE 9/11 Truth?
Yes, that originally evolved from our research into Building 7 when David found the stiffener plates. When he found that in particular, one of the people who came forward who was willing to help us and verify what we were saying was Tony Zambotti, and he put an incredible amount of work into not just what we did, but he added to it. He was able to bound the problem in a more precise way. And in that way, the connection between our original research and how it evolved, the connection between our research and architects and engineers developed really through Tony Zambotti adding to and refining what we did.
Well, that's excellent that you bring that up, because, of course, we have spoken to Tony Zambotti about precisely that collection of issues a few years back. So it's fascinating now to be speaking to members of that very group that brought these things to his attention in the first place. That's great. Okay, can we move then on to the data that you've actually obtained now via FOIA request? Of course, when we spoke before, you hadn't got the lot, and it was important that we shelved what we did so that you had the opportunity to get absolutely everything. And I understand you have got all you expect to get from NIST. Is that right? What have you got?
Well, when the Building 7 project moved really out of our hands as a research group, I set about trying to discover what kind of data we could acquire about the Twin Towers. I could see what difference the access to the structural drawings had made to our research into Building 7. When you're looking at the towers, the immediate thought is, can we get structural drawings for the towers in the same way as we did for Building 7? So my first port of call was to get in touch with NIST and begin to request structural drawing books that they had listed in their report as having used when they were putting their report together. So I began to do that. And I honestly expected a stock answer of, no, this will jeopardise public safety. You're not getting it. We're, you know, no chance. And I thought, well, just do the due diligence and ask. And to my surprise, to my very pleasant surprise, NIST were entirely helpful and couldn't do enough to help me. And these drawing books began flooding in. So I got three books that Tony had made me aware of. I think it was Tony. Somebody had made me aware that these three drawing books were out there. And I requested them, and that started the stream of drawing books flowing. And from that, the torrent just started pouring in for these books, to the point where we now have a full collection of the structural drawing books for the Twin Towers.
You have the full set of structural drawing books. Is that seven books or is it more?
It's more. The books are numbered 1 to 13, uh-huh. And then there's books 17 or 18 to 20 and book D. There are some numbers of books there that we don't have, but NIST say that they didn't use those books. They say that they weren't used, but they don't make it clear whether they didn't use them or whether those numbers weren't originally used.
Okay.
If that's clear, we've got everything that NIST used to make their model, basically.
Okay, so you are able, in principle, to critique their work because you have everything that they relied upon in their work.
Yes. For example, we needed to do a similar kind of analysis to the towers and create a finite element analysis model along the same lines as what's come out of Alaska.
Oh, yes, which we're going to discuss. Yeah, if anybody who's not sure about what that means, we'll flag that up in a minute. Go on. Yeah.
Yes, I apologise for that. The drawings are enough for us to know every detail about these towers. It's akin to having all of the pieces of a jigsaw, but not necessarily having the picture there. The more you start to put it together, the more it takes shape. You know, we have all the pieces, but we don't have, at the minute, we're lacking framing plans, for example. We could reverse engineer those if we had to.
Okay, so I get the general picture. So these structural drawings, now I'm going to ask you a question that may seem unnecessary, but there's a particular reason why I want to ask you this.
Okay.
Do they accurately reflect, do they substantially accurately reflect how the towers were actually constructed? Now I'm asking this because some people might say that whatever you find, whatever your conclusions are invalid because the towers themselves weren't built 100% or even 90% according to these structural drawings. There were differences. You know, these drawings just a sort of a rule of thumb. But they're more than that, aren't they? They're not just a rule of thumb.
Yes. As I said, I had chased down details and data, and so had the rest of the team for years before these drawings came into our possession. So we had put together a huge collection of videos and pictures that were taken of the towers, both of the towers, throughout their construction from beginning to end. So we have these details and we can go in and say, there's the picture of World Trade Center building number 2 at floor 85, and there's the trusses, and go into the drawings now and have a look and say, well, do the drawings say match what the reality is? And they do.
Mm-hmm. And NIST says the same thing.
Yes.
These match the reality of the situation. There isn't some third document which NIST could say, oh, you're looking at the wrong set here. It's actually this document you should be looking at.
There's also, I think it's drawing book 19. I might be wrong in saying that, but it's one of the late drawing books is revisions after construction.
Mm-hmm.
So the revisions that were made after the construction, you know, you look at a building, any project, particularly something on this massive kind of scale, is going to have teething problems. You know, there's going to be snagging.
Okay, so
revisions.
So those, yeah. But those do those any of those revisions substantially change your or challenge your conclusions about what you're finding?
Absolutely not. No. The building is. It is what it is. And when you look at these drawings, the level of detail that's in there is just incredible. I don't think it would even be possible to model this thing to the exact specification that it is. You know, if you were going to the detail of putting an antenna on it and stuff, it's just so big. You know, you have to at some point make some kind of compromise within the modelling of the building. I think that goes without saying. But when I see the compromises that NIST have made, I can see a very similar pattern to what we found when we looked at Building 7, and that's quite disturbing.
Indeed. Now, you mentioned Dr. Leroy Halsey's team's work at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and of course they've been producing this draft report. They've been working on it for years about Building 7. Presumably, is your hope that what you're finding now, these sort of anomalous findings of your group, will be passed on to, at some point, to somebody like him and his group, or perhaps even to him and his group, to produce a similar kind of research project? Is that your hope?
It certainly is. It's a prospect to have that opportunity there, to have the data there that is necessary to put together those kind of analysis and those kind of simulations. I think there's a good bit of work to do toward looking at what exactly we would want to be analysing on a smaller scale in the building. Mm. With Building 7, we had a very, very specific initiation event described by NIST, or a potential initiation event of this girder being pushed off its seat at floor 13 at the column 79 connection. That's very precise. When you look at the report about the towers, it doesn't have that kind of precision about it. So there isn't something there directing us to a very, very specific area of the tower so that we can go and say, well, we want to look at this very closely in an analysis. I think there's a lot of work to do between the observations of what actually happened to the tower and then how does that translate to elements failing and moving within the structure.
Okay, well, let's move towards something a little bit more precise here. We will be returning, hopefully, to the Dr. Halsey team report when we talk to Richard Gage later. So we'll get a little bit more information about that later on. Now, am I right that you are concentrating mostly at the moment on one of the twin towers in your research?
Yes, we're looking at the North Tower in particular at the moment.
Okay.
No,
I was just going to say, could you give us an impression of what the official narrative is with respect to that North Tower collapse so that we can then see how what you're saying contradicts that? So what would you say the official narrative is about that collapse?
The official narrative is very much revolves around sagging floor trusses, failing and leaving columns unsupported over a length, and therefore columns beginning to buckle. The observations that can be seen in the North Tower is that around 10 minutes before the collapse, the south face of the tower, which is the opposite face to that which was impacted, begins to bow in just below floor 96. And it bows in quite a lot, and it bows in right up to the corner. So NIST had to account for those movements in the building, those observations in their report. So they say that there's a failure at that side that translates up to the structure. It's called a hat truss that supports the antenna on top. So we get a bit of movement from there. But then at some point, NIST state that global collapse ensues. That's their explanation. Global collapse ensues. So NIST did not study the collapse of these buildings.
So
they never studied that.
In order for global collapse to ensue, we have the core of the building failing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, as far as they're concerned, caused by these floor trusses sagging under the effect of fire. Is that right?
More or less, yes. The floor trusses sag. They fail. When they begin to fail, there is a longer, an extended length of columns that is left unsupported. In this opinion,
mm-hmm.
Their story more or less revolves around that. But they kind of, again, they try and cover every base. They try and leave their options open. this might have happened. This could have happened.
Yeah. Okay.
Uh-huh. And that makes things very, very difficult. And I think that really the opportunity that's being presented with the data that we have here is to be able to say, well, what does cause sagging floor trusses to bow perimeter columns? Mm. Because when you look at this explanation for that, they add a 5 kip lateral force onto the outside of the column to get it to bow in. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's just, you can't just conjure up 5 kips out of nowhere and apply it to a model.
Okay, you'll have to explain what a kip is.
It's just the units of force. Mm-hmm. 5,000 pounds of force put on this column. It's the way to imagine it is a huge gust of wind focuses itself on one of these columns and it begins to bow in as a result of it. That's basically what NIST have done. And I mean, quantifying it, I don't know how much we actually gain from that, to be honest. Mm, mm. It's enough to know that this imaginary force has been applied laterally to these perimeter columns in order to get them to bow. Well, if it doesn't bow in your model, then you go and you look for something else.
Yeah.
You don't say, well, we'll conjure up this force that makes it do what we want it to do to make our report easier to write.
Yeah, indeed.
That's just not how science works.
No. This must be the same thing that Kevin Ryan was speaking about when he came on the program and said there was an imaginary force operating here and there in their theory. So, I mean, this is not a fudge factor, is it? This is not presenting a band of possibilities with respect to a particular variable in something. This is introducing an element for which I understand there is no evidence. There's no warrant for it at all, other than to bolster a particular theory. Is that it?
Well, a force exists that did cause these perimeter columns to bow in because we observed that happening.
Yep.
The question is, how does a failure in the building translate structurally in order to cause those observations to happen?
Absolutely, yes.
And when you look at that, one of the theories that we're working towards here is that when the core failed, the floor truss connections to the perimeter of the building were still strong enough and the floor was still strong enough in order to exert that pull of the core dropping onto the perimeter of the building. That sounds an awful lot more complicated than it is.
Okay, we're going to have to try to pull this apart then. Okay. Now, we had a couple of days ago, we had a go at this to try and put this into words in a very sort of illustrative way. So it's to conjure up an image. And because a lot of this is very visual, you've sent me pictures, graphics, photographs, etc. And what I'm going to do is, with your permission, I'm going to put some of these in the show notes so that if anybody wants to listen back to what we're saying here and actually consult those images, that will help us now to refer to those images in real time. But we're still trying to describe what's going on here. Now, you very helpfully had a go before explaining what's going on here. And once I twigged what was going on, it didn't seem, as you say, as complicated as it sounds. So where shall we start with this? We've got these trusses, we've got the core, we've got the perimeter of the building, we've got sagging going on, but you're calling into question how significant this sagging is with respect to the collapse. Why should we start with this?
If we imagine we're going to have a game of X and O's, or if we call it tic-tac-toe, I don't know what the...
This isn't noughts and crosses, is it?
Yes, noughts and crosses.
Yep.
Okay, so we're having a game of noughts and crosses, and you draw the board originally for us to go there. The centre square... If we imagine that to be the core of the tower. Mm-hmm. Now, the core of the tower is actually rectangular.
Okay, so a badly drawn noughts and crosses.
Yes.
Yep, okay.
Yes, a badly drawn one. Now, if we imagine that the centre one is the core, if we then look at the four corners, what you can see is that if you were putting straight lines like floor trusses to go from the perimeter toward the centre of the building so that people could walk, mm-hmm. What you can see is that in the four corner squares, if you were drawing those lines, they wouldn't have a direct connection to the core. They would have to transfer to the core, and they would do that via a transfer truss.
That's
perhaps not...
Yeah, it's difficult to describe these things. So if anybody is sitting there doing like I am, and you're drawing a box, and then inside that you're drawing the noughts and crosses... lines. And right in the center, I'm coloring this in black. So that's the core. It should be a rectangle, should be an oblong, but there we are. I just made it a square. I should have made it an oblong. I'll make it an oblong. That's an oblong now. And I can see that if I'm going to support the floors from the perimeter to the core, well, I suppose I could go diagonally across, but that's not right, is it? It doesn't go diagonally across. All these are lines that go, as far as my drawing is concerned, they go down or across. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So as I draw these lines in that bottom left-hand box, I'm doing lines straight down, or I'm doing lines straight across, and I can see that none of them are connecting to the core. They're connecting to beams or something that are coming out from the core. So, yes. Yeah, I can see they don't connect to the core.
They would be connected to the top and bottom lines of the right and left center squares. Yeah,
exactly. So anybody else who's drawing that now probably can see that as well, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this connection then for these trusses that don't connect to that center rectangle, the core area, these would be slightly heavier. They're quite heavy-duty trusses, and those are transfer trusses, and they transfer that load back to the core. The floor system in the towers, that's really its job. It's a connection between the perimeter and the core. Mm-hmm. And the core in this building will only really take gravity load. It doesn't take any of the lateral load, which would be the wind force in the building. The wind force is all taken by the perimeter in this kind of framed tube construction.
Okay, so we're to believe that the fire, well, this is basically the fire operated upon these trusses?
Trusses, yeah, yeah.
And there was enough sagging then to pull?
Yes, this is where it begins to get interesting, because if you imagine that the floor trusses that have a direct connection to the core, you can see how that's substantially stiff. Mm-hmm. The core, you know, that connection can get real purchase on the perimeters. But then when you go over to the left or the right of the core and look at these trusses that are connected to the transfer truss, well, the transfer truss isn't as substantial or as stiff as the perimeters. So what we're beginning to look at is if these trusses that are in what we would call a transverse area at the corner, what do they have to use to pull these columns in? And they don't really have anything, because the transfer column truss would begin to distort before the perimeter of the building. So what we're looking at now is that the core dropping was able to pull in these perimeters. And interestingly, that tells us how strong the floor connections to the perimeter must have been.
So you're presenting something that sounds almost like the inverse of what we've been told. Is that right? That these trusses sort of pulled on the core in some way and caused the core to fail?
The core failed and then pulled in the perimeter by way of the trusses, which doesn't entirely go against what Nestor's saying in every sense, but the ability of a sagging truss to pull in that perimeter is really what's in dispute here. What we would be putting forward is that, first and foremost, as has been found in Building 7, the floor system that is above the floor trusses, in other words, the floor pan, the concrete, the reinforcement, the shear studs, all of the rebar, all of this stuff that reinforces the floor system and indeed makes it composite with the trusses below, all of this stuff serves to make this building so stiff that that part of the floor system is actually a lot stronger than the trusses themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, it's quite an important point, I think, to realise.
So could you summarise the basic points at which what you're saying fatally contradicts what NIST is saying? I mean, what you say obviously doesn't contradict everything. It doesn't obviously contradict everything, but what is it about what you're saying that is significantly contradicts what NIST is saying?
Well, for example, you could argue that we could agree that this building did initiate in the same place as NIST say it did. Mm-hmm. But then to look and see how fire would cause that core to drop, is pretty difficult. And to make the connection that NIST have to say sagging floor trusses are what caused that core to drop. That's what caused the, you would call it an offloading. In other words, the perimeter columns offload their gravity load back to the columns in the core, and that overloads that. How can a sagging truss do that? How can it lead to that? If you need to add a 5 kip force to make it do that, then you really need to go and look at another cause that, to cause the same failure in the same area.
Yes.
What's the alternative cause? Because this one doesn't work.
Okay, now I just need to clarify this, because I'm obviously something is missing here in what I'm following you, because okay. I thought you said that the sagging trusses didn't, in the official position, that the sagging floor trusses didn't cause the core to fail. Now you're saying something along those lines, that the official position is something along those lines.
Well, the sagging trusses leaving the perimeter columns less able to take load caused that load to be offloaded back to the core.
Uh-huh.
So
right.
The two failures are connected as far as NIST are concerned, but the cause for these failures is what is in dispute.
Yes, yes. So you're actually saying that the data that you have, the way the structural drawings illustrate how the building is actually constructed, the nature of that construction, the quantification of those materials, does not support what NIST are saying.
We can test what NIST are saying now that we have that data. That can be tested, although the calculations right. to do with the difference that this 5 kip force has made have been done by people other than us. That was already an established point. As you said, Kevin Ryan had mentioned it. And we also stood on some of his research to do with Building 7. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of nice as well that, you're saying, you mentioned yourself there that Kevin mm-hmm. Ryan has already discovered some of the points that we're making. And I suppose it's good to make that clear that some of the research that we've put out is stuff that people like Ron Brookman, for example, have done, or Tony's done, you know.
So have you actually found things independently of these other people, or are you depending upon each other?
What we've found independently is that we're now able to look at how substantial the bridging trusses were. Mm. And I'll explain what bridging trusses are to you. When you were drawing your lines on your knots and crosses box before, if you imagine, you have these straight lines running of the trusses. If you have trusses running at 90 degrees to that, in order just to stiffen them, to make the whole structure, to tie it in.
Yeah.
So they're running at 90 degrees. They're bridging trusses. And these were left out of NIST's model in what they call the one-way zones. So the areas that are directly opposite the core, just to the inside, they left all of these bridging trusses out. And they also left out a thing called strap anchors, which means a load of shear studs that you put a strap anchor, kind of triangle-shaped things that you put just to make the building more stiff at the edge of the floors and where there's any openings. Those were missed out. There was a lot of concrete reinforcement missed out. It actually sounds like a carbon copy almost of the way that they approached their analysis of Building 7. There's elements missed out.
Right.
We haven't been in... Sorry.
No. I was just saying, right. That reminds me of the conversation with Tony Zambotti.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were flanges and things that weren't there. They're there in the drawings, and then they're not apparently on the later drawings when this releases its report. And they said something like, well, we didn't need those in our calculations. I can't remember exactly what was said, but something along those lines. And, of course, the question is, well, what's the justification for saying you don't need them? it was very suspicious. Yes.
Yeah, that was the stiffener plates.
Yeah.
That was David from our team that discovered those. And I should say, I've watched the evolution of the Building 7 argument, if you like, from the beginning. And I should say, to give David Cole his due, that really anybody who was involved in that project more or less could have been replaced. But if David hadn't did the work that he'd done, if he hadn't discovered those stiffener plates, if he hadn't went over those drawings and looked at them at the kind of depth that he had, it wouldn't have got off the ground. So, you know, I think that should be made clear. Mm. David Cole really is the guy who got us here. He's really the engine, the driving force at the heart of our group in terms of research.
The unsung hero, really, of what's going on here.
Absolutely, yes. And he's not somebody who we can see today. He's not somebody who comes out and talks a lot and stuff. But I think it's important to recognise the input that so many people who don't perhaps stand in the limelight so much, the contribution that they make, some of them, is absolutely astounding.
Okay, all very interesting. I think there's a slight disconnect between what you are saying and what you are perhaps critiquing in the minds of people, certainly in my mind. So perhaps we need another illustration to bring this out a little more. Have you got anything up your sleeve that might help us to understand this better?
I think one of the main issues that we're looking at is that these core columns that are in the centre of the building, there's 47 of them, they have a huge amount of bracing between them. They're tied together with steel beams and quite securely connected. But then they also have the concrete floor of the building extends straight into the core from the open office area into that centre square in our noughts and crosses thing. The concrete extends directly into there. So directly above and below these impact points, that's all intact. That's all there. And that's all making this structure very, very stiff and very, very stable, both above, I would say, and below the point of impact. Mm. And I think that that's something that hasn't been accounted for in this analysis. And it would be interesting to see the difference that this highly composite, hugely reinforced concrete floor with the floor pan and trusses, with all of these elements, what difference does that make? Because we've seen in the Building 7 analysis that one of the things that made a huge difference to the rigidity and indeed the redundancy of the building was the concrete floor and the reinforcement that was there within that concrete.
Well, this is one of the features of this kind of conversation. We knew this was going to happen, that it may feel slightly disappointing to people that you're not coming up with the answer, the final answer to the wall so that everybody can read it. This is ongoing research. It was when we last spoke, but it's still going, although you have more to work on, it's still ongoing very much and will be for some time. But, you know, you've got a lot of data here that you didn't have before that is throwing up these very significant questions. And one of the things that comes to my mind about all this is that people sometimes say that the sort of physical stroke engineering questions are given too much attention with 9/11 truth, you know, 9/11 studies, that area, that we're sort of going around in circles all the time considering these things. We should be looking much more at the sort of the political things going on at the time. And I'm sure, yes, there probably has been too much of a focus on this sort of structural approach. But on the other hand, to now take our eyes off the kind of questions that you're asking when this data is coming to light would be a huge mistake, not least because we now have, as we're going to discuss soon, this draft report from the Halsey team, which is actually giving teeth to these kinds of observations. And it looks as if you chaps continue with your work and pass on what you're finding, maybe we'll end up with yet another report of similar stature that's going to give yet more teeth to the Twin Tower aspect of this as well. So we certainly should not be taking our eyes off this whole field of research, even though we may indeed be wise to talk more about some of the other wider aspects of 9/11 that may have been neglected over the years. So, you know, I'm really pleased that you're doing this work and very enthusiastic about it, even though it's such a long time ago now, still extremely important because of everything that it led to and is still leading to. One thing that do you want to say anything there? I have another question for you, but if you want to throw something in there, please do.
You know, the work is ongoing, the analysis is ongoing, and it has to be done, but Newton doesn't lie. You know, the political side of this versus the science, we go into this openly. If we'd found in Building 7 a likely cause to suggest that fire could do this to a building, then that would have been something we would have been screaming from the rooftops. That would have been something that was of huge value, because we can then go around and see what other buildings may be susceptible to the same kind of collapse. So, you know, we didn't go into this looking for holes in this analysis. If we had found something that had come up with an alternative fire-based hypothesis, then we would certainly have put that forward. And in the same sense, I'm sure those that we passed that data to, if they had found something, they would also have put that forward. And I think in that way, that answers the question that Newton doesn't lie. The science, the data doesn't lie.
And unfortunately, the way in which that can be framed can be filled with lies. And
because we
are human beings and we have human institutions and science is presented by institutions, etc. So, yeah, there's always room for that. But I take your point that science properly done is the science done and it's there and unarguable.
You can check
level.
It.
Yes, that's right.
You can go and check it. If people release their data,
check. If they allow you to look at what they've done, which, yeah,
yes.
Right. There we go. So the last question that I have here, yeah, this is something you brought up that it's just interesting to note this. You talked about the distribution of mass in these buildings, and it was quite an eye-opener to me the way you described it. You described it something like, you know, you'd expect it to be the mass to be distributed in the building pretty much evenly from top to bottom, but actually it's not because you can't build these things like that. That in fact, in terms of the mass, you would illustrate that as a kind of rather slender pyramid reaching to the top. Do you want to tell us about that and how that feeds into our intuition that these buildings couldn't have been, well, it's very unlikely they would have sort of been pile-drived down to the ground?
Yeah, if we continue with the North Tower, for example, that was impacted around floor 96, which means that there are 14 stories and an antenna above there. That looks like more than it's 10% of this building. You know, it's 15% or so of the building in terms of the height.
Yeah.
In terms of the mass, I reckon that's only about 5 or 6%. Of the building. You know, this at the bottom 35 floors or so of this building, that's where more than half of the mass is. You don't need the structure to be a substantial higher up because it doesn't have the same gravity load on it. It's not got as much above it. So the extent to which these elements taper as the height of the building increases is quite substantial. You know, the core columns at the bottom, the base of these buildings are huge. And we're being asked to believe that 4 or 5% of the mass plus the antenna destroyed 95% of the building. That's difficult to comprehend how that just happens. How can that happen? It's difficult to see. Certainly, when you look at these towers coming down, I think that's important to keep that in mind, that even though you're looking at a height proportion of the building that's coming down, you can't translate that proportionally to the mass that's involved. It's very much less. The floors are more or less consistent, but the core columns and the perimeter columns taper quite substantially.
Yes, I found that very helpful point. Okay, so we're going to be talking to Richard Gage, hopefully, very soon. Just before we go to him, I want to ask you, you know, what stage you chaps feel you are at with your work. I mean, do you feel like you're just on the cusp of handing it over to someone else, or do you feel like you've got quite a long way to go before you seal the envelope and say, look, here's what we've found, and pass it on to the next?
We're certainly very close. We're at this stage just now where we're beginning to look at what was omitted from the analysis that was performed originally on the towers and being able to quantify that very precisely to say this was what was left out, these were the compromises that were made. There does come a point where you have to pass this information on, and it's a difficult decision to say when is the right time to do that. And I think we are approaching that point where we need to more or less write up our findings and publicise those and see where that goes. That's not to say that our research will end there, but certainly we need to really take stock of where we are, the data that we've got, and the issues that are thrown up as a result of that data.
Excellent. Well, thank you ever so much, Jerry and David and Hitstirrer, for being on the show. Your group actually being here on the show with us today, that's fantastic. Now, let me invite you, if you wish, to stay while we talk to Richard, or go if you have to.
Okay.
Yeah, and we've got an okay there from Hits. And okay, so we do in fact have Richard Gage with us today. It's great to be speaking to Richard Gage again. We spoke with him a few years back, actually. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, Richard is, I'm sure vast majority of you will know, but I will repeat anyway, just for those of you who don't know, Richard Gage is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 30-odd years experience and a member of the American Institute of Architects, and he's the founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, which now has, as of today, I checked, 3,001 members who are architects and engineers signed up. Others, of course, who are not, I think 22-odd thousand others, members of the public, and they are demanding a new investigation into the destruction of all three World Trade Center high-rise buildings on 9/11. Okay, Richard, thank you ever so much for joining us again. It's good to speak to you.
Thank you, Julian. It's great to be here.
Now, of course, as I said before, the vast majority of people will be familiar with you and your organization, but there will be some who are not. So could you very briefly explain your organization, what it's seeking to achieve?
Yes. We have 3,000... as you mentioned, architects demanding a new investigation based on the evidence, irrefutable evidence, of the destruction of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. And this evidence has been given on many occasions to every member of the U.S. Congress and the media, mainstream media in the U.S. And it is compelling, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with you today.
Excellent. Yeah, now your work has obviously developed over the last 4 years or so, because it was 2015 when we last spoke. And there are three things in particular that I would like to ask you about. There may well be things that you would like to share in addition. They are the Bobby McIlvain World Trade Center Investigation Act, the New York Area Fire Commissioners, their resolution, and of course the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. Well, actually four things. We've got the Halsey study as well. So could you tell us what the Bobby McIlvain World Trade Center Investigation Act campaign is?
Yes, it's an act. It's draft legislation that would require a new investigation of the destruction of these towers. Bob McIlvain is the father of Bobby McIlvain, who lost his son in the North Tower due to explosions. He has researched the evidence quite thoroughly and has found that his son, his face was blown off as he was entering the North Tower prior to even to the plane's hit. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that there were explosions prior to the planes hitting the buildings substantially in the basements, as numerous witnesses have come forth with. So he's inspired us to bring this draft legislation to all of the members of Congress, and we met with them early on September 11th, again this year, along with the fire commissioner, Christopher Gioia, who, along with five other commissioners of the Franklin Square Munson Fire District, have unanimously voted for a resolution demanding a new investigation as well.
Okay, so this is the one where the resolution say, now therefore be it resolved that the Board of Fire Commissioners of the Franklin Square and Munson Fire District fully supports a comprehensive federal grand jury investigation and prosecution of every crime related to the attacks of September 11, 2001, etc., etc. So that's quite surprising to read, because, of course, that entails that we've not been told the truth, and they are, by saying, making that resolution, basically saying that and calling for the truth to be revealed.
Yes, and they did that rather dramatically on the morning of 9/11 at the National Press Club, where the four of us gathered together, each of us giving our respective demands, if you will, and evidence, beginning with Chris Gioia, the fire commissioner, followed by Bob McIlvain, followed by myself, announcing the release of the four-year University of Alaska study on the destruction of World Trade Center 7, the third skyscraper that came down on 9/11. And this study concluded that that building did not come down due to fire, as was claimed by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain these collapses to the American people. It came down due to the near simultaneous failure of every column in the building over an 8-story distance. In other words, 650 columns simply were removed all at once. Well, how does that happen? That can only happen by explosive demolition.
Well, I'm going to ask you more about that study in just a few minutes from now. I just want to ask you, how is this resolution by the fire commissioners, etc., and the push for this Investigation Act, how is this actually being received by the authorities? What's their reaction to it?
Well, the reaction of Steve King, a representative from Iowa, a Republican, was startling to me, because normally I'm met with deer in the headlights kind of syndrome by these politicians. They do not want to deal with this. This is a third rail activity. But this particular representative was asking keen questions, for instance, about the nanothermite that was found in all the World Trade Center dust samples by an international team of scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. He was looking at the photograph of the destruction of the Twin Towers, and he said, that doesn't even look like a collapse. That looks like a waterfall. Well, yeah, that's what you get when you have thousands of explosions going off from the top of the building all the way down, identically in both the North and the South Towers. So
it certainly doesn't look like a classical demolition of a building, does it?
No, the North and South Towers were a very explosive demolition, with 4 and 8-ton girders hurled laterally at 80 miles an hour, trailed by thick white smoke clouds, impacting buildings up to 600 feet in every direction all around each tower.
But that's one of the things that's sort of on the other side of the equation of this. When you look at Building 7, I think virtually everybody who looks at it thinks that looks exactly like a controlled demolition. And even the BBC has said, yes, we admit it looks like a controlled demolition, but we have reason to think otherwise, etc. But when you look at the Twin Towers, it does look different. So I can see why people say, well, perhaps the hypothesis of demolition doesn't fit, because these are seemingly so different phenomena going on here.
Yes, it can be confusing to the beginner looking at this evidence. But like Steve King, the representative, he was just amazed at the evidence and asking very intelligent questions. We also got very intelligent questions from the representative from Alexander Ocasio-Cortez's office. These people are intent on following up, and we will be following up with them, developing a base so somebody from either side of the aisle and from either the Senate or the House can introduce this legislation so that we can begin the process of discussing a real unimpeachable investigation with subpoena power that'll bring forth witnesses who have been granted immunity so that we can get to the bottom of the real story here.
Okay, so these people are making the right noises. You're obviously enthusiastic about what's going on. How confident are you that it isn't just the right noises and nothing's going to happen in reality?
Time will tell. We don't have a crystal ball. We've been at this for 12 years. We're not naive. This is a difficult subject for anybody to handle, let alone political candidates who have to run for office on more popular issues than this.
But as you say, it is remarkable that you're not just being sidelined immediately and taken seriously in what you say. That is remarkable, and that is cause for celebration in itself. I want to ask you also about this lawyers committee for 9/11 inquiry. They filed a petition, is that right, last year with the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, but I understand that the U.S. attorney has actually gone along with this. Is that right?
The U.S. attorney has agreed in writing to comply with the law, which requires him to give these 60 exhibits to a grand jury, a special grand jury, to investigate them. So this is very good news for all of us. The Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry was formed in 2013 when we testified to this group, probably a dozen of our experts from among the 3,000 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Dave Meiswinkel, the president of the committee, the Lawyers Committee, also gave a press conference. He was the fourth on the morning of 9/11 updating everybody about the progress here. And we have not heard progress from the U.S. attorney. Hmm. So they have filed a mandamus action requiring them to prove what they're doing regarding their compliance with the law here.
All right. So they are actually required by law to follow through on this and produce a grand jury. Is there any way in which they could get around that legally that you know of?
Perhaps. They're being watched very carefully by the Lawyers Committee, and the mandamus is a pretty tough play to do an end run around.
Okay. So if a grand jury is actually convened and these exhibits are actually investigated openly, then tell us what a grand jury looks like and if it finds in a certain direction, what the consequences of that might be.
The grand jury is a body of 16 to 23 citizens. This comes from English common law, actually, and we have inherited it, and it's been called a fourth branch of government. It's so powerful, this citizen's opportunity to not only judge their purpose is to investigate crime and find out if there's a reason to indict. If they do indict individuals who have been named in this process for information and investigation, then we will for sure begin to have more representatives in Congress take a closer look at this and pass the Bobby McElvain Act for the investigation of the three World Trade Center skyscrapers destruction.
Yes, indeed. It's very exciting. So these would just be regular citizens. Would they be chosen sort of at random, or would there be some clandestine system of choosing people who might choose the right way?
There's a process for impartial selection of jurors in the country. I'm not sure of the details.
Mm. Okay. Now, the main thing that I wanted to ask you about is the Dr. Leroy Hulsey study that has been published in draft form so far. A lot of people will have heard about this. So he heads a group at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the name of the study is A Structural Re-Evaluation of the Collapse of World Trade Center 7. And those people who are not deeply aware of it, let me just say what the executive summary reads here, because it is eye-opening. The principal conclusion of our study is that fire did not cause the collapse of WTC 7 on 9/11, contrary to the conclusions of NIST and private engineering firms that studied the collapse, which is, you know, just looking at that, that's an earth-shattering sentence there. Okay, could you explain to us who is Dr. Hulsey, what's this group, and what's your connection to that group at Alaska?
Dr. Leroy Hulsey is the professor and chair at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And he's one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country. He was approached by one of our supporters to look at Building 7 and analyze it. And they did, after a while, decide to take this on because we've been told by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain this collapse. And they said it came down by normal office fires. Well, office fires have never brought down a skyscraper before 9/11 ever. So if this is true, then this should be one of the most studied buildings in our history. Mm. If a building can fall at free fall acceleration straight down uniformly, symmetrically, by the way, after witnesses hear explosions, it falls in the exact manner of the old hotels in Las Vegas that we see here on TV in the States quite a bit. So this is an extraordinary state of affairs that Professor Hulsey said, well, we got to look at this. So he sought to examine the assumptions of NIST because they did their own finite element analysis modeling. And he found that there's at least a dozen inaccurate, substantially inaccurate, I would call them fraudulent assumptions on the part of NIST and manipulations in their treatment of the input data, which, of course, you get garbage in, you get garbage out. And he found that For instance, they made the exterior wall infinitely stiff in their model, which when the fire loading was applied to the 12th and 13th floors around column 79, which is the area NIST focused on for their theory of collapse initiation, the floor began to move not toward the elevators, but to the exterior wall in the Halsey study, completely invalidating the results of the NIST report because of this false stiffness, infinite stiffness of the exterior wall that NIST produced. So that's just one example, and omitting key structural components throughout the areas of critical concern here, which were clearly installed in the building and because they were in the shop drawings. Well, Halsey actually used all of their incorrect assumptions, and he still couldn't get the building to fail at all, progressively. And so what do I have to do to get this building to collapse? He says, well, let's take out all three columns, 79, 80, and 81 numbered columns. And the building doesn't start with a progressive collapse, as NIST claimed. It begins to tip over as the exterior columns are overloaded. So, gosh, how do we get the building, he says, and his team of PhD researchers to come straight down as they saw in the actual videos of the collapse? We have 11 videos. Well, gosh, he had to take out 650 columns at once, within a second of each other, to get the building to fall straight down uniformly, symmetrically into its own footprint, as the videos show.
Yeah.
Well, what can do that?
Not fire, not office fires, anyway. And you've got this fantastic video demonstration where you have the, I think it's in the center, you've got Building 7 coming down, looking like it's a controlled demolition. Then either side, you have on one side the University of Alaska's image there, and it's coming down where he's indeed removed these structural elements all in one go. And then you have on the other side of it NIST's animation, which doesn't quite look like the actual event at all.
So let's talk about what it does look like, because it's quite interesting. Their finite element analysis shows the building begin to crumple up like a beer can, which is what you'd expect in any type of a natural collapse like that. But the videos don't show that at all. So they can't even get their own computer model to mimic what the videos of the collapse is doing. And it begins to tip over. Curiously enough, so they stop it after only 2 seconds into this 7-second collapse. They don't even show us what happens next, because it would be completely pull the rug out from underneath their deception.
Rather too embarrassing to show off. Yeah, I think everybody should look at that particular animation. It's a video, isn't it? It's on YouTube, but I can embed it in the show notes. And I do encourage people to go and look at that, because it is eye-opening, to say the least. Did NIST cooperate at all with Dr. Halsey's team's work?
No, I don't even know that they were asked to. We have certainly had plenty of correspondence with NIST along the way. But the object of the University of Alaska study was to do an independent analysis.
Okay, so you weren't dependent upon looking at the way in which NIST itself had gone about researching this. This was completely independent of NIST.
Certainly independent of NIST, but they absolutely reviewed the 1,000-page report that NIST produced in an effort to obscure this information from architects and engineers, most of which still, to this day, know nothing about the third worst structural failure in modern history. I, as a member of the American Institute of Architects, one of 80,000 members, have not received one bulletin on this, the collapse of this 47-story skyscraper. Again, it should have been the most studied structural failure in history.
Now, I understand from talking to these other chaps, who I hope are still in the background, that you know, the debunkers are already working on this and calling into question this analysis by Dr. Halsey's team's group. Are any of those challenges, to your knowledge, substantive yet? Or is this on the level of nitpicking, trying to muddy the waters? Is there anything out there that is, you know, that team, that Dr. Halsey's team, needs to take on board and go back to the drawing board and say, yeah, we really didn't consider that properly?
Well, there's about 80 comments so far that have come in, and we're starting to go through them now so that we can have the University of Alaska incorporated into their final report, which is due out at the first of the year. One of the comments that I have heard is that the resolution of the animation is not as fine as the LS Dyna software platform that NIST used. And that's true. NIST has millions of dollars to do a very detailed set of animations. But that is only what happens after the initiations of collapse. And so that is not, that does not impact the credibility of the actual computer finite element analysis, which shows what fails and when and where. What the finer resolution animations show is what happens after all of that. And you need millions of dollars to do such a thing, and months to even, or weeks to run the animation itself, which NIST had complained about being, that's why they say they took 6 years to come up with this analysis, which they finally reported in 2008, and 7 years. And they still have all of these problems that they've been hounded about.
So we have at the moment a few weeks left for questions to come in to the group, and they're going to incorporate those or review those and come out with their final report. Is that actually going to be in November, do you think?
The final report comes out at the end of the year.
The end of the year. Okay, so that is, I suppose, an informal kind of peer review, but is there a formal peer review process going to take place at the point when it's finally published?
There will be articles that will appear in peer-reviewed journals,
right.
Absolutely, after the final report is done. The study itself is being peer-reviewed as we speak, though, even prior to the final report coming out.
And do you know,
those comments will also be incorporated.
Do you know roughly who is doing that peer review? I mean, is it broadly spread across the relevant academic disciplines, or would it be just people who agree?
No, it's people who have proven themselves credible in structural engineering, like Robert Coral from a Canadian university, and Gregory Zudolinski, an expert in finite element analysis, and several others. So this process is an internal process. The external process is we've invited universities across the country. In fact, today we're mailing 128 physical copies of this 126-page study to universities and organizations across the country for external peer review as well.
And presumably you're hoping that when all this process is completed, that this will be a bulk of research that can be presented in tandem with the political effects that you're intending to produce as well, with the act that you were talking about, etc., and interesting those in government.
We certainly expect those in government to be armed with these studies, which pull the rug out from the official report of this building's destruction. And of course, that's just the beginning step for those political representatives, because once people, you don't need a four-year, $300,000 study to see that the evidence is very compelling for explosives and incendiaries in the destruction of all three of these towers, which we haven't even discussed yet on this conversation. But that's those are the key elements of evidence. This study is simply a backup
and
an effort to get the attention of those who won't look at forensic evidence or eyewitness testimony, but who need an academic report from a credible university. But we've got both sets. Of compelling, we'll call it evidence.
You are very welcome to actually go into some of the detail of the way in which you present evidence with regard to the collapse of these buildings. But we have spoken about that before, so I wanted to concentrate on these aspects first. One thing before I go any further with you is that I wanted to ask you about the collapse of a building in Tehran. Because this has come up on social media a lot, and I've noticed it. And, you know, people have said that you and your organization have said things like no steel-framed high-rise buildings ever collapse due to fire, etc. And there we seem to have a counterexample of that with just such a building coming down because of fire. Does it undercut what you're saying?
Not at all. First of all, the statements we use are very careful. Okay. No steel frame skyscrapers ever collapsed prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm. That's true. And in the case of Tehran, this Plasco building did not collapse due to fire. It collapsed after explosions were heard and seen on the videos, and after molten iron is seen pulled up by the bucket loads as this building is being cleaned up. Molten iron is the byproduct of thermite. Thermite is an incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. So once again, you have a building which was owned by the Republican Guard of Tehran, who was trying to get rid of their tenants in that building so that they could redevelop that site. So that gets into motive. But what the evidence itself shows is the evidence of thermite and explosions at the ignition of that of those thermite cutter charges. So it's a fascinating study, which is on our website at ae911truth.org. Just search for Plasco Building, P-L-A-S-C-O.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, I hadn't heard of that. I thought it was just being presented as a counterexample, but it's interesting that you have that angle on it there, that in fact, well, according to what you say, is it seems to support your hypothesis after all, rather than going against it. Do you want to tell us a little more about the hypothesis that you tend to favour at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth? Some people will not have heard it before, many will, but for those who haven't, it would be interesting for them to hear what your position is.
Yes, regarding Building 7, just on the surface of it, you have a 40,000-ton structural steel frame, which is fireproofed. So the whole initiation of collapse theory ignores the fireproofing. The steel couldn't have gotten hot enough to expand because the fireproofing is 2 and 3 hours protection. There's not enough time for a fire in any given area, even acknowledged by NIST to be 20 or 30 minutes for a given area, to heat up the steel. So it doesn't become a problem, which is the reason we've had 100 much larger, longer lasting and hotter fires in these buildings that have never brought down a skyscraper. So that alone is evidence. But then you look at the actual collapse and you say, well, what's happening here? 40,000 tons of structural steel is giving way all at once. So this building falls as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky. What does that mean? That means not one of these 82 columns gave any resistance to this building's collapse. It's falling at free fall. So just think about that. How could not one column on any of 8 floors, 650 columns, give no resistance? Okay, well, what happened to them? Well, that's where we look at the aftermath down in the pile. Temperatures exceeding 1,300 degrees documented by NASA overflights of thermal imaging software showing 1,300 and 1,400 degree temperatures on the surface of Building 7. Well, there were no fires on the surface, and yet those temperatures, those Fahrenheit temperatures, probably 700 or so degrees Celsius, those are hotter than most office fires ever get, and yet there's no fire. Well, what are they measuring? They're measuring the temperatures, which are twice those temperatures, that heat, down in the base of this pile, in which first responders see molten steel, they call it, flowing like lava. They've never seen this before. The ends of the beams partly evaporated, according to Jonathan Barnett, fire protection engineer, author of the FEMA report, which came in the first couple of years. And the first year after 9/11, they document the steel partly sulfidated with hot molten iron invading the grain boundaries of the steel. Well, where does all of that come from? Again, molten iron is the byproduct of thermite. Incredible temperatures not achievable by normal office fires or jet fuel, for that matter, because the same molten iron evidence is exhibited in the World Trade Center towers, where we have molten iron pouring out of the South Tower minutes prior to its collapse, where we have molten iron microspheres in all the World Trade Center dust samples documented by the U.S. Geological Survey and R.J. Lee Group, an environmental consulting firm.
Okay.
Billions of molten iron microspheres. That's the evidence of ignited thermite. It can be nothing else.
Now, you say it can be nothing else. People say that it could have been caused by welding.
We're talking about 10 tons of molten iron microspheres. Welding is inconsequential in terms of the amount there. So, I mean, to think about this, R.J. Lee says these are formed during the event. This is a forensic expert group, international engineering group. They're formed during the event. Well, how would they be formed? Well, if you had thermite incendiaries going off under pressurized conditions, it would aerosolize the liquid molten iron. And that's the only rational explanation for all these spheres, which occur not just in the pile, but for a couple of miles around in Manhattan. This dust is found on the Brooklyn Bridge. It has molten iron microspheres in it.
And
it also has the...
As Hitster has just texted here, after all those years since the thing was constructed, then they would be oxidized. Presumably these spheres are not oxidized, but not to the extent that one would expect after 30 years.
Yeah, which means rusted. Mm. Yeah, molten iron. This is elemental iron in a spherical form, and they're naked to the human eye. And they have the chemical ingredients of the residue of thermite in them, not the chemical signature of welding, in addition. But what else is found by a team of eight international scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen and all the seven samples sent to them, these red-gray chips, which they do deep analysis with. They are attracted by a magnet. They're dual layered. They thought they were paint at first, but it turns out that they have aluminum and iron oxide particles that are 1,000 times smaller in the diameter of a human hair. This is nanoparticles of what is called super thermite, which was developed prior to 9/11 by Los Alamos Lab. It becomes much more explosive because of its extremely small size. The chemical reaction is almost instantaneous. So this is documented in a 24-page peer-reviewed paper in the Bentham Open Chemical Physics Journal, which is called Active Thermitic Materials in the World Trade Center Dust. Well, why is this in every sampling that they found, in this case, again, on the Brooklyn Bridge also, in this powdered concrete, which layered across lower Manhattan in a 3-inch, 9 centimeters thick blanket, which is composed of what, by the way? Concrete powder, powdered concrete, 30% of it. Well, I thought the concrete floors should have been stacked up at the bottom of either of these towers, 110 floors, each an acre in size, and yet they're not stacked up. They've been distributed and pulverized in midair and drifting over a 3-square-mile area across lower Manhattan. So what destroyed the building? What crushed those towers? If it wasn't this 90,000 tons of concrete, which is outside the footprint of these buildings, but it's not the concrete and it's not the steel either, Julian. The steel is distributed, as I mentioned earlier, up to 600 feet outside the footprint. So that's most of the way to the building. What crushed the building?
Well, we did, in fact, in the early days of this podcast, have a conversation with Dr. Niels Harrit. Fascinating conversation, and I will direct people to go and listen to that because he goes over this in great detail. And he mentions paint as well, and he says something like, well, if that's what they painted on, then, all well and good. But it was very, very combustible paint, very strange paint. One question I have here is, and this is a bother for a lot of people, I think, even if one accepts the idea that thermite or nanothermite can produce this kind of effect, how on earth would you get all that material into the buildings in order to do this? Whoever perpetrated this, how on earth would you get it in there without being noticed?
Well, you would have to be noticed by security, and that's why we want an investigation of Securicom Stratasec, the security company that had the contract, curiously enough, up till the day of 9/11. Who's on their board of directors? Some interesting characters. Who had the elevator modernization the 9 months prior to 9/11? The largest elevator modernization in the world. ACE Elevator came out of nowhere to capture this contract from Otis Elevator, who had been maintaining these elevators since the time they installed them. Why did ACE Elevator's 85 employees flee when the planes hit the buildings instead of helping the firefighters rescue those victims using the elevator cab's key rescue vehicles for them. This was quite a scandal documented by USA Today. So, yes, we want an investigation of security and the elevator company who would have had access through that modernization to the core columns and beams in the towers.
And I'm asking this question because people have asked me about this myself. Do you have any connection to the theories along directed energy, weapons and that sort of thing? Or are you sticking with the nanothermite as your major hypothesis on this?
Well, the forensic hard evidence reveals the use of thermite. Hmm. It does not reveal the use of directed energy weapons. The people who support that say, well, the steel was turned to dust. Well, none of the studies show steel dust in the World Trade Center dust. What they show is 30% concrete. Up to 6% of these samples are previously molten iron microspheres. That's hard evidence for thermite, which is unexplained in the official story. So I don't have any positive things to say about the directed energy weapons theory, particularly since its main proponent, Judy Wood, denies the evidence of explosions, for which there are hundreds of witnesses and dozens of video testimony, if you will. She denies the evidence that there's a massive heat here, which is flowing molten iron at 2,800 degrees, documented by numerous official sources. She denies the evidence of thermite and nanothermite, so which is, we've been talking about the evidence. So why give credibility to an unsupported theory, especially when its proponent denies the most basic evidence that we do have for the thermite and nanothermite theory?
Yeah.
And high energy explosives too, which I think would be required to pulverize concrete to a fine powder.
Well, thank you very much, Richard, for giving us that overview of the picture. Obviously, we had a conversation before with you about 4 years ago, which I think we spent even more time talking about these things. So I will direct people to go and listen to that previous interview as well. And of course, many of the things that you've been talking about, and indeed the chaps before have been talking about, are connected with issues we brought up with Kevin Ryan and Graham McQueen, Niels Harriet, and a number of people of considerable standing looking at these particular issues. Is there anything that you would like to add about where your organization and its campaigns are at now? What's the next stage for you and your various campaigns?
We're marching forward with the major cannonballs that we have, which are already putting a dent in the armor of denial out there. The wall, as we call it, it's a huge problem for us. This societal denial. People can't imagine a crime of this magnitude, and yet it has occurred. And so waking people up to the realities of this false flag operation, this inside job, if you will, is very difficult. No matter how hard your evidence is, it's hard to get people to look at it because they immediately contemplate the implications of it, and they just can't go there out of fear because it turns our world upside down. It makes the world a very unsafe place. Yet we're marching forward with this evidence in the media, with our elected representatives, and across the universities now. So that's what we're heading into.
And things seem to be getting better, don't they, in terms of public consciousness? Because I hear there are perhaps even a majority or a slight majority of people are not really satisfied with the official story about 9/11. That must be in part the effect of you and groups like your group over the years.
I hope so. I hope we've been doing some good. We've been at it, it's actually 13 and a half years now.
Wow.
So time marches on. We've certainly been a stable force in the 9/11 truth movement and are honored to have millions of people out there who have seen our DVDs and who are passing them around in our videos currently on YouTube, like 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, which we put together 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, controlled demolition experts, all laying out the evidence, which we've scratched the surface of today.
Do you have any comment to make about the tower drawings and the work that Jerry and his team are doing?
Sure. Jerry has been the bulldog after NIST, pulling on their pants, and the pants have come down. NIST has released the drawings now to us, the structural drawings, which we've been after for years and years, over a dozen years. And so here we now have the structural drawings available to us on the heels of the release of the Halsey study from the University of Alaska about Building 7. We now are fully capable of modeling World Trade Center 1 and 2 and the claims that NIST has made based on their false input data and so forth. We'll be able to prove that. But that'll take quite a fundraising drive to put that study together. It's much more complex.
Right.
And I believe also Jerry has now received a finite element modeling input data, which he's more qualified to tell us about.
Well, we said at the top of the show that it's quite surprising that NIST has actually come up with all this information. You'd think that they would have held on to it. Why on earth do you think they have revealed it? I mean, it's a matter of law that they should, but I mean, what could have been pulled out of the bag is, well, I'm afraid it's national security or public safety or something like that. Why do you think these have been revealed?
I don't know what's going on in NIST's mind. They're not really talking to us about that. Jerry might have more insight on that one.
NIST haven't really refused anything that I have asked them to do with tower drawings. You know, to be fair to them, and they have in the past. I've had letters from them that have said, "No, we're not giving you that, this or that information because of public safety." But in terms of the towers, to be fair to NIST, they have actually been very helpful to me in providing those. Why they would want to do that, I don't know, because I don't imagine that they're analysis is going to stand up any better than their World Trade Center 7 one is, to be honest.
Well, I'm all for being fair to NIST. That's fair enough. But one would imagine somebody breathing down their neck and saying, I'd really rather you don't reveal such and such. But that doesn't seem to have happened.
Not in this case, no, but for whatever reason. And I mean, the additional data, and I have to, again, credit David Cole with managing to get a hold of additional data from NIST. That's very new to us. So we're in the process now of looking at that and assessing that to know exactly what we do have. But that's certainly as big a release as the tower drawings, in my opinion, potentially. And that is, again, credit to David Cole and his tireless work as well towards NIST.
So, Richard, when this work reaches a certain level of fruition, then I think you've already said that you would like to move that work into something more formal, a formal study, let's say on a parallel with the Halsey study, which would require, of course, money. How much money did it take to kick off the Building 7 study that's been draft reported?
It's a $300,000 effort raised through hundreds and hundreds of our supporters over 3 years. 4 years now. So it's going to take more than $1 million for sure to hire a firm or university that can model the World Trade Center study with hopefully this time the LS-DYNA software platform, which would give the kinds of resolution we'd love to show as to what happens dynamically after the initiation of collapse.
And would you anticipate such a study being longer than, is it the 3 or 4, indeed 4 years that this has taken?
It shouldn't have to take that long. I think there were some extenuating circumstances with regard to the availability of the schedule of Professor Halsey being the chair of that department, civil engineering, and his PhD researchers.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Richard, and thank you, Jerry. I know that Hitster has just left us. He had an important appointment to go to. Thank you ever so much, Hitster. And David, if you're still there, thank you very much all for being on the show today and discussing all this in quite some depth. I do find, having looked at 9/11 now for quite a few years on the show and talked to, as I said, quite a few people of key significance in this movement, you know, I find what we've been talking about today very, very hopeful, really very hopeful that the truth about this is being opened up in a more rigorous way. And hopefully this is going to have a tremendous impact, even legally going forward, scientifically going forward, and maybe it will become more and more socially acceptable for people to say, yes, I really do have doubts about this, and the conversation's not being shut off with your conspiracy theorists, because, you know, there are these significant developments happening, and I do find this very, very hopeful and inspiring. So thank you all again for coming on. I think the listeners will echo everything I've just said there. Thank you. It's been a delight to speak to each of you.
Thank you, Julian. You too.
Thank you very much, Julian. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you all.